There we go.
Here's the blue light. Blue light special. Today we're going to hold a public hearing on Senate Bill 1533, and we're going to then go into recess and tentatively come back here at 2:30 to take action on Senate Bill 1507. And that's because the paperwork isn't quite ready, and hopefully it will be then. So let's get started on this housing bill. I'll open up a public hearing on 1533A. Kyle's going to give us a brief explanation, particularly on the construction excise tax component of this bill, which is why it's before the Senate Revenue Committee. I will say this is a pretty ambitious bill to drop on the Revenue Committee at the end of the third week of a 30-day session. So we're going to do our best, and I'm hoping that different factions with different interests in this bill can come together tomorrow and over the weekend, and I'll facilitate wherever I can. But if we don't have a bill ready to pass out by Tuesday, we can't make it. That's too late. We still have to get it to the floor and to the other chamber. So Tuesday will be the deadline for this bill to live or die. Kyle.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So before I get into the description, I would also mention that we have heard that there may be some amendments that could be coming in, so you may see those in OLIS as they pop up, but as of the start of this hearing, we hadn't seen any, so I'll be describing the engrossed version of the measure. And as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, there is, you can think of SB 1533 in almost two parts. They're not distinctive. There is some intertwine between the two, but one is related to what's why they described as inclusionary zoning or inclusionary housing. And then the second part, and largely the reason that's before this committee, is the effects on the construction, the local construction tax. So I will briefly touch on the inclusionary zoning part, and then I'll spend a little more time describing the local construction tax. So 1533, as I said, the first part is related to inclusionary zoning, and it would remove the prohibition on inclusionary zoning or inclusionary housing, and it does limit the adopted regulations of the city or the county. Those are the two that would be allowed to do that. Their adopted regulation or provisions, it is a limit to require no more than 20% of the housing units within a multifamily structure to be sold or rented at below market rates. The bill also specifies that the requirements can only apply to multifamily structures that contain at least 10 or 20 housing units, and that depends upon whether you're in a city or county greater than or less than 600,000. And it does require the city or county to also offer affected developers in-lieu payments and other incentives. And these other incentives will tie into the construction tax. But so the local construction tax, just as a brief reminder to take the committee back to 2007, Senate Bill 1036 passed in 2007, and what it did is it put a moratorium, more or less, on local construction taxes with the exception of school districts. So K through 12, all local governments were more or less not allowed to impose local construction taxes going forward. The ones that were in place were grandfathered in and allowed to continue. But the one set of districts that were allowed to impose construction taxes were school districts, and Senate Bill 1036 did specify how those taxes would be in place. They're based upon the square footage, and there's some indexing to allow them to keep up with the rate of inflation as well. Contained in Senate Bill 1036 was a preemption, as I said, on the other districts, cities, counties, and special districts of being able to impose a local construction tax. That moratorium was until 2018, so it'd be lifted at the beginning of 2018. So at that time, under current law, local districts will start imposing construction taxes again. So that's the framework for the current law. What SB 1533 would change is it would eliminate the construction tax preemption that would normally go away in 2018. It'd eliminate it immediately, but then it would replace it with requirements of a structure and limitations of the construction taxes that can be imposed by local government and local service districts. The tax is limited to 1% of the permit valuation of improvements to the residential and commercial and industrial real property. It does require the construction tax, the proceeds of the construction tax, they have to be used to fund developer incentives, programs related to need in housing, fund homeownership down payment assistance programs that are administered by Housing and Community Service Department, and there are portions of the tax revenue that will stay with the local governments in their general fund. So the bill does specify the percentages of where those funds will go. and it does take effect the 91st day following adjournment signing time.
Can you give us a hypothetical of a new residential project coming into a city and how the tax would be imposed, levied, and where the money would go?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So it is, I would start off first by saying it is permissive, so there's no requirement to put these taxes in place. So if one was put in place, the limit is 1%, but it could be something less than that. And it even, the way the bill's set up, it's allowed where you could have a different percentage for on the residential side to the commercial industrial side. So those two sides are split out, and even where the funds go depend upon whether you have a construction tax on the residential side or the commercial industrial side. So if you were having, say, a multifamily structure coming in or something to that effect, that would be on the residential side, and it would depend upon what the tax rate is there and then the permit valuation of that project. So you find the permit valuation, and then you'd apply that against the tax rate. Those funds then are used, if you're on the residential side, the proceeds in that case on the residential side, 85% of those would be used to fund those developer incentives related to the inclusionary zoning piece or other provisions related to needed housing. And then the other 15% of that revenue would go to the down payment assistance with housing. So it's the, if you impose on the commercial industrial side, is where 50% goes to housing and then 50% stays with the local governments.
Okay. Mr. Chair, the dash A4s are up. On the, or dash 4 amendments have been posted now.
Just came in.
Sam Bercher,
question of Kyle.
Yes. Could you give me an example of developer incentives?
Oh. I can, Senator, because there's actually examples in the bill, so I will use those ones.
Good plan.
But, yeah, so in 1533, the engrossed version, it's on page 2, starting about line 18. It's a requirement. There's two kind of requirements, I guess. The first is you must offer a development of payment in lieu, an in-lieu fee in exchange for providing the inclusionary zoning pieces, and then one or more of the following incentives. So it describes density and adjustments, fee waivers or reductions, expedited service, local permitting process. There's also finance-based incentives. And then also included is state-authorized property tax exemptions or abatements is also included there, so offering those. There are some that are available to the local governments that they can put in place, so those ones are already available, so they could offer those as well. So that's another way that it could touch on the tax system, I suppose.
I guess, but are we limited to those?
It looks like it does say must offer one or more of the following incentives. So I believe as long as they fit within those categories, I suppose. Finance-based incentives is listed there, and exactly what that would mean could be rather broad, I suppose.
And
Senator Riley.
So the way I read this, you have to offer one of those, but it doesn't prohibit you from also offering others.
Correct.
In addition.
Yeah. It's one or more of the following.
Mm-hmm. For the record.
Okay. We have a lot of people who want to weigh in on this, and so I'm going to ask you to keep your comments very brief. If you have written testimony, you can submit that, but do not feel the need to read it aloud to us. Senator Dembro is here to briefly address this bill, and I know you're working on some amendments,
right,
too, so if you could briefly give us your hopes, dreams.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Haas and colleagues. You know, I think in your presentation of it, you hit it quite correctly. That is, what you have before you are the engrossed version that incorporated what were at the time the Dash 2 amendments. Just as we were about to pass those, because those Dash 2 amendments included the construction excise tax, we got the word that it would have to be referred to this committee for you to look at, particularly that piece of it. In the meantime, a kind of framework agreement was orchestrated by the speaker that included a number of housing issues to create a kind of package. And I would say that there's large agreement about that overall package. There were some concerns about issues specifically related to inclusionary housing and Senate Bill 1533 over on our side of the building. And so we've had further discussions, and I think we have nailed down now conceptual agreement on a final set of amendments, which we're hoping will go in by this afternoon and will be available in time for your next meeting, which is Tuesday, is that, Monday?
We'll hold a work session on Monday and Tuesday.
Okay, great. You know, with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Those amendments will clarify, actually, the point that Senator Bertschinger raised about whether there will be an opportunity for additional incentives to be agreed upon, and it'll be made clear that those kinds of voluntary agreements will always remain in place as part of the overall mix when a project is being developed and agreed upon.
Any questions? Senator Edwards.
Thank you. Senator, could you clarify who's on first? Okay, so I've had three or four meetings in the last 2 days with folks coming in saying that they had concerns about the bill. And I thought that what had come out of your committee had been amended with the, quote, the speaker's deal. And I didn't realize that it hadn't until my last meeting of the day, or one of my last meetings of the day yesterday. So people have been coming into my office saying, with laying out concerns, and I've been saying, I think I'm fine with it. I think I'm fine with the bill. I thought that everything had been taken care of, and well, then come to find out it hadn't been. And so the way that I read the landscape right now is that there is not agreement across the board on these. And I think they're the dash. We have the A4s that have come up. I haven't had time to read them. And so I'm just wondering from your perspective where we are in the process. Mm-hmm. There's been talk about the definition of, some definitions in the bill and a definition of affordable housing and some other fine points that seem to still be quite in flux. And so I'm trying to, on a short timeline here, trying to figure out who's supportive and who's not supportive at this point. And I say this because to try to get that same type of input from all the people that come up to testify after you.
Right. Yes, and please listen to what they have to say closely, and then let me know. I have to go to another committee, what they said.
I'll be taking notes.
But Chair Hass and Senator Edwards, you know, we have had a lot of conversations over the last couple of days, and my sense is, you know, although, you know, the lawyers are looking at the kind of final language, I think we do have agreement on what will replace the dash fours. The dash fours didn't come out until yesterday, midday yesterday, you know, I think they largely got it right, but there were a couple of areas where they didn't. I think that by about 4 o'clock yesterday, or maybe no, it was probably more like 5:30. It allowed me to feel comfortable coming to you today to say that we're on track. But you may hear something different because it was a long night last night. Great. Thank you.
I'll call up the City of Portland and its team. Okay. And as I get set up with your comments, Senator Edwards and Senator Dembrow, that, you know, trying to get the perfect bill, as we have said many times in this committee, there is a place right outside the Senate doors where perfect bills are buried. I think if we have everyone trying to achieve perfection on this, this bill could go the same way as tobacco licensing from 2015. So I'm hoping that compromise and collaboration will be the order of the day here. So, Martha.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Martha Pellegrino with the City of Portland. I will keep my remarks very brief today and pretty much echo Senator Dembrow's remarks, which is Portland is very supportive of this underlying bill. We've been very appreciative of the discussion so far. There is a housing crisis that we're trying to address in the city of Portland. No other communities throughout the state are also feeling the pressure of the housing crunch. And we look forward to continuing to work on this bill to see if we can reach an agreement. And at this point, it is there are certainly some very important technical issues we have to work through to make sure that the bill actually has its intended effect. And that intended effect is building more affordable housing units, substantially more than we're building now, and also balancing it with what the development community needs. And from the very beginning, we've taken a very balanced approach. That's what we want to see happen, and we certainly appreciate this committee's work on it. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks and look forward to the discussion. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Questions for the city of Portland?
That didn't.
Senator Edwards?
Yeah, I mean, with what amendments? I mean, I mean, we're running out of time for,
yes,
like, vagueness.
Yeah, exactly, Mr. Chair and Senator Edwards. Senator Dembro remarked there was a set of amendments that was released yesterday afternoon, and those were amendments that were a result of conversations over on the House side. And so what we're doing is really working through the finer technical points to see if that those particular amendments will have its intended effect. So at this point, we're still reviewing those. I cannot tell you definitively today whether we can make an inclusionary zoning program worth exactly that language, but I think we're working to make sure that that happens. So I wish I had a better report for you, but again, we haven't had much time to review those. I understand there's some other amendments to the work. So I think there's a lot of different things in play. I think everyone is working in good faith toward the same outcome, and we really hope to have a better update for you soon.
Okay. Senator Barchuk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have to, you know, kind of jump on with Senator Edwards said, we're running out of time,
mm-hmm,
and personally, not speaking for other members, we've got other bills we're working on, okay? So if you run this thing down to the clock, I think the chair made a statement, it may not happen, so please keep that in consideration as you go forward.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bertschuger, we absolutely will, and I think your sentiment is shared by a number of people in this room, and we really are, we'll work around the clock to make sure we can get there. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Martha.
Thanks.
Gwen Baldwin, John Rogers, and Bev Logan.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Hass and members of the committee. Gwen Baldwin representing Multifamily Northwest. I'm coming to you today filled with optimism. Optimism for an agreement that, frankly, I didn't think was possible about a week and a half ago. On my sign-in sheet, I had it marked as supportive of the dash threes that has now morphed to the dash fours, and I expect there will be another number before we are finished, but we are very mindful of the time constraints and the fact that you are getting this sort of plopped on your desks. In a nutshell, and I like agreeing with Martha whenever possible, the whole point of this is to create more housing at all levels of affordability. If we do our job right, we will not reduce or hamper building. We will inspire and create more building of all levels. And that's really the delicate balance that I think is achieved in large part by the dash fours. They aren't perfect yet. There are technical issues. You know, you don't want an abatement that goes on forever and ever past the rent restriction period. So there's some technical issues that we're working out. But the frame basically is that the hammer, if you will, the requirement is at 80% MFI for up to 20% of the units in a structure and a minimum of 20 units to a structure is when that trigger comes in. The partial or whole tax abatement piece is important to the rental community because if a pro forma changes over the course of time after various sales and the rent restrictions are still in place, it's important to have that offset. If you've seen in the Vertical Housing Development Program and other abatement programs that you have seen in the past, it's really important to align those to the time frame and to make sure that they really work. At the same time, a full abatement may not be the most productive and appropriate way to handle this, so we want to have that flexibility, and that currently isn't reflected in the draft. So that's one of the reasons why we want to make sure it has maximum flexibility and really speaks to the construct that then the agreement that was developed. Although I'm not certainly the expert in the construction excise tax, I think it is valuable and important to have a new revenue stream that can help facilitate for certainly, especially smaller cities, the ability to provide those offsets and those incentives. And so I think it's a marriage that works really well. We don't support the base bill as it sits, 1533A. We very much believe we have an agreement in the works and look forward to bringing it to you very soon.
Okay. Let's go ahead with you guys. Go ahead, sir.
Chair Hass and members of the committee, my name is John Rogers. I'm a leader in the Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good, which MACG, which is a Portland Tri-County organization with 24 member institutions and thousands of individuals within these institutions. I come today not to, as a technocrat, understanding all the details of this, but come aware of thousands of stories of people in our institutions who are in housing crisis. We believe that there's a duty to contribute to the common life we share across differences of belief, race, class, and citizenship, a duty to contribute to the common good that we hope to build in our cities, state, and nation, and world. Dr. Martin Luther King said, "We are tied together in the single garment of destiny, caught in an inescapable network of mutuality." MACG leaders strongly support lifting the ban on inclusionary zoning. We're troubled by a ban that for 17 years has benefited developers, leaving unmet the needs of housing among working class and low-income citizens. The ban has effectively prevented any city in Oregon from addressing their housing needs on a broad and meaningful scale. Our economy has gone through many changes. Sacrifice and loss are inevitable within change, but that sacrifice needs to be shared by all. Instead, the ban and the booming housing market have benefited developers and the well-off. They have caused a traumatic upheaval and loss to countless families across our state and to local governments and nonprofits. Oregon is in a housing crisis. Rising rents, unaffordable housing, and historically low vacancy rates have been well documented. In 1999, developers wrote a bill that the Oregon legislature passed banning the use of inclusionary zoning. Now they're at it again, trying to distract the conversation and block our efforts to repeal the ban. It's time to bring Oregon values, smart growth, sense of community to our housing crisis. We should not allow developers to dictate housing policy. It was a mistake in 1999, and it's a mistake now. Oregonians in small towns, large cities, all across the state, from healthcare workers to store clerks to those working three part-time jobs, are struggling to find affordable places to live. Affordable housing that is accessible to schools, amenities, work, and other opportunities means Oregonians can thrive in livable communities with farmlands protected from sprawl to produce food and a healthy climate for future generations. We urge you to support Senate Bill 1533, an inclusionary housing policy that will work for local governments, developers, and residents alike. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Hass and members of the committee, my name is Beverly Logan. I'm also a leader with MACG. And last week on the, or earlier this month on the House side, our leaders shared a few of the countless stories we've heard of people in impossible situations because of the housing shortage. We are years behind in Oregon, at least 17 years behind, in addressing the critical need for affordable housing for working families and people with low incomes. As city after city in Oregon is moved to urgent action on a growing housing crisis, they find their hands tied by that ban. They may find, in fact, that the crisis has emerged in large part not because of our land use system, but precisely because of that IZ ban. Oregon's urban growth boundary is unique in the country, yet affordable housing crises are happening across the nation. When Washington County expanded the UGB, critical farmland was swallowed up for a few more McMansions. It produced zero affordable housing, nor could it have for those who need it most, who need to be near jobs, childcare, school, community services, and food, by the way. As people of all kinds have created or preserved the magnet, that hot market that developers benefit from, developers should expect to contribute back to the good of the communities that made their success possible, to the good of the communities that have suffered so much under their ban. The bill in front of us at this point suggests instead that government will subsidize developers' contributions. We find the poison pills that have been attached repugnant and counterproductive. And yet, we ask that you help pass it because there is no time to wait. I'll just say that the cost of damage control, if this ban is not corrected immediately, really, very soon at least, the cost of damage control will be more than any city can bear in its social services budget, its foster care, education, health care, parks, transportation, and prison budgets. Despite the things that have been added onto it and complicated it, we ask that you pass this because we cannot wait for more options for affordable housing. Thank you.
Thank you for that, and appreciate your point. Housing crisis is expensive in ways that we don't see besides just the crisis and other social services. Questions of this panel? All
right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank Tom you. Hughes and Randy Tucker from Metro.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to come before you today, and I'll try to be both brief and fairly specific in terms of what we like and don't like about this bill. I could be more general about things we like and don't like about things in general, but we are very supportive of the underlying bill because we think that it's important to provide those tools to local governments for inclusionary zoning and increased renters protections get after the problem, the crisis that you've heard a lot about of housing. We recently convened a housing summit in Portland and had about 250 of the Portland area folk who are most involved in trying to get after the crisis. And the one thing, I think the one message that came out of that conference loud and clear is that there is no single solution to the problem. There's got to be multiple solutions. And so inclusionary zoning and some sort of renters protection offer two bullets in what have to be a fairly extensive ammunition supply. What we do not support are the amendments that do a couple of things, and we think are a bad trade to get inclusionary zoning. So, understand that the bill includes an inclusionary zoning authority that is relatively weakened by conditions. So it is, it's really not a full-blown inclusionary zoning authority, and to trade that for amendments that continue the general preemption on construction excise tax and a very limited allowance for the CETs to be used for housing, but only by cities and counties. And I think obviously since we don't fit either of those categories. A part of our concern about it is that it continues a preemption on our ability to create a construction excise tax to use on housing. And let me talk just very briefly about a couple of reasons why I think there is advantage to an entity like Metro having the authority to do a construction excise tax that could be applied to housing. As mayor of Hillsborough, which I did for a number of years before I got this job, I was always very frustrated because Hillsborough was one of those communities in the metro area that always was fairly receptive to the idea of enlisting in programs that created more affordable housing. If there was a federal program that offered financial support for subsidized housing, we were on board. And in fact, in Washington County, when all of the money didn't get subscribed, when we first said we'll give us some more. Then there are other communities in the region. Portland is the one that stands out the most, I think, as a willingness to accept affordable housing projects. There are cities and other jurisdictions in our region that do not do that. And one of the things that that's created is it has created a problem for equity. There are communities where people who are low-income people or people who struggle with making payments on housing cannot live simply because the city has, through a variety of tools, zoning, system development charges, and other things, made housing too expensive there. And those cities are not the ones that stand in line and say, give us more tools to do affordable housing. If you leave this tool, the ability to convert construction excise tax into grants for affordable housing, if you leave that up to the cities, the same cities that have affordable housing now will have more, and the same cities that don't have affordable housing now will continue to not have any. By authorizing Metro to collect the tax and apply the tax, Metro would have the ability to finance projects regardless of whether the local jurisdiction was looking for that affordable housing project or not. And I think that that's a particular way to help us try to bring about equity in the Portland area, at least. So this measure, the amendments that have been proposed on this measure would preempt us from being able to do that. And it also would preempt any expansion of the construction excise tax that we currently have in place. So we would oppose both of those elements of the amendments. And we've passed out the copy of the handout from the conference that we had, and also I think we're going to make available to you some additional notes on talking points on the bill. So I don't know if Randy wants to add something.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. I've got very little to add. I just want to say that this handout that we've given you is just the short summary of a much longer report. We have a lot of resources on our website related to equitable housing. We've established this equitable housing program in the last year or so, and it's really gotten up and running with quite a bit of good work. The other thing I've submitted, and I've submitted this, at least a link to it electronically so it can get posted. And the other thing I submitted for the record is just a one-and-a-half-page summary of what Metro is using the construction excise tax for now, what we're doing about equitable housing now, and how we might be able to use the construction excise tax to support equitable housing in the future with expanded authority that if we were added to the bill. And just lastly, I'd like to note that I looked quickly, sitting in the audience here, at the dash A4s, and they do not seem to address our concern. So,
could you remind us of what authority you have now for construction tax, what this would add, and if you had it, where would be the first place you would go?
So we currently have construction excise tax of 0.12%, raises about $2.5 million a year, and we give that out in terms of grants to local jurisdictions who are interested in doing the master planning for urban growth boundary expansions. In fact, within the life of the construction excise tax, about most of the 26,000 acres that has been brought into the urban growth boundary has been planned using construction excise taxes. So that's been a valuable tool for us. The preemption grandfathered that in, but it doesn't allow an expansion or a change of use. And in fact, a few years ago, when we when we added to the list of projects that we could fund, projects that were in corridors and centers within the urban growth boundary, we were sued. We successfully withstood that suit, and so we're able to do that. But that's what we are not allowed to expand beyond the amount that we clear, but beyond the percentage that we collect, or those fairly limited uses. I think that if we had an opportunity, we've talked over the years about a number of ways to use the construction excise tax to address needs. One obviously is the housing crisis. Another would be somewhere along the way would be to provide some sort of grants for planning and implementing the expansion of infrastructure demands in the region. So I think that having a permanent preemption is probably bad public policy, and doesn't allow us to a full use of that. We've not used it to support our own agency. We've used it to basically to promote the idea that there needs to be planning done for these parts of the region that have been expanded into. So,
with respect to this construction excise tax, Tom, devil's advocate question, wouldn't it be a redundancy for Tiger to have it and Metro to have it as well?
It is conceivable that Tiger wouldn't have it because they felt they couldn't raise sufficient amount of money to do any good, whereas Metro in the Metro region could raise a significant amount of money and give it to Tiger as a grant. So I think that we could probably be persuasive to our local jurisdictions that they would actually get more of usable funds if Metro collected the tax. I don't know if they'd say that right now, but
Mr. Chair, could I just add one comment? I think the amendments limit the tax to 1% on any given property, and I don't think we're suggesting any change to that, so that if the local government were imposing the tax, it wouldn't change that cap.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. So we don't want to do double tax.
Right.
No, not at all.
Questions of Metro?
Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you
both.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So let's go to Nikki Terzieff.
Good morning, Chair Haas, members of the committee. Nikki Terzieff here on behalf of the unique Inclusionary Zoning Coalition. We've got local governments and labor unions and some industry folks, some developers and builders and realtors, and also some advocates, and they're all pulling in the same direction. And that direction at this stage is for the base bill, which is 1533, as it's engrossed sitting before you today. We have come quite a long ways. Some of you may recall last year, this first iteration of the bill was, I think, six numbers, three letters, right? Just repeal and ORS, and it was very simple. And since then, it's gotten complicated, and I'd say probably we'd all agree that the issue itself is complicated, so the solution probably warrants something a little more sophisticated than just a straight repeal. So we've entered into conversations, and those conversations have included giving up the ability to build single-family detached developments, and that's currently before you in 1533, is now down to just multifamily units. There is a 20% cap and a 20-unit minimum. The 20-unit minimum is great for those localities that are specified in 1533. For those localities that are lower than 600,000 in population, we'd like to keep this 10-unit minimum, which is inside the bill that's before you today. We have a lot of concerns around the dash threes, the dash fours. I assume when I stand up, there's going to be a dash five, I'm not sure. But we'd like to see the bill that's before you move out of this committee. There are a lot of other pieces in the building, as have been implied, that are kind of tied to this conversation. The CET is an important tool and one that can be dedicated to affordable housing and one that should be preserved. But some of those other pieces and questions may raise the hair of other coalition members. So I won't speak for them, but I would like to say that 1533, as it's before you, is the bill that really should go. That is the bill that many folks at the table understood was a part of the negotiation. And the things that keep coming are kind of gumballs in a child's mouth until it's so full he can't even chew. And we'd just like to see this move.
As a parent with kids, I appreciate that analogy. Questions? Okay, thank you, Nikki. All right, Sean Gillian's John Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Gillians today representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I appreciate that Ms. Terzieff is including some of our members in her coalition. They're free to have their own individual opinions, but I actually speak for our association. We are here in support of the Dash 4 amendments in some modified version. We have been having ongoing discussions, Senator Edwards, to your specific question about where the bill sits right now. We did not have final agreement on the bill when it moved out of Senator Gelser's committee, and we were still in negotiations. And so at that point in time when we went up on the record, we said, we think we're getting close, but we don't think we're quite there yet. And when they took a recess, we talked to some of the members on the committee and assured them that there would be some additional changes that you see in the Dash 4, hence why you got it out unanimously, because we anticipated there'd be further changes which were reflected in the Dash 4. So I think you would have had a different vote coming out of Senator Gelser's committee had we not sort of had assurances that we were going to have additional changes. We are supportive of an overall comprehensive package, as you've heard, Mr. Chair, that is a little more complicated than just this bill. We have been working on this issue, John and I, for a number of years. We feel that our land use system also plays a role in driving up the cost of housing. Did we get everything we wanted in the land use discussion? Absolutely not. We got a small pilot project to sort of prove our theory, and that's what we got. Very emblematic of this building that you don't always get everything that you want in a bill, but we're at least getting a small portion of that in exchange. We agreed to a new construction excise tax, and we also agreed to lift the existing preemption on inclusionary zoning with some sideboards to ensure that the unintended consequences of mandating affordable housing don't actually drive up the market rate units, which, you know, Senator Edwards, we've had a number of conversations with you over the last couple of sessions about that concern and how things could be done wrong. The other thing I'd like to get at, Mr. Chair, is in this package of things, there was a very interesting report that was in the Washington Post yesterday that effectively said we need to be building nationwide a lot more market rate units as well, that market rate units are actually helping to spur affordable housing because you get people who are moving up from their existing housing, from their starter home into the next level. And it was actually a study based out of California that sort of said, quite frankly, inclusionary zoning is not all that effective in keeping people from being displaced in their neighborhoods. And in fact, creating more market rate housing was the best way we could address that. So I know Mr. Chandler's going to touch on sort of the number of building starts that we have in the state, what the state economist says we should actually have. We feel like this package, with its money going back to housing, with the lifting of the preemption for local governments to opt into for inclusionary zoning, with dealing with annexation and with dealing with land use, that we've achieved a good balance. Mr. Chair, you have our commitment that any technical issues we have with the Dash 4, we plan on having done today. I made the commitment to you yesterday that we wanted to have an amendment you could move today. Unfortunately, we didn't get there, but I promise you from our perspective, we'll have something for your next meeting that we could fully support. With that, happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of SB 1533 with tweaks that I'll reference. This is, and I know the committee is feeling frustrated at the time of the session and the fact this issue is right in front of you. It's scarcely a new issue, though, and I'll talk to more to that in a bit. But just to give you some of the context, this we've had, and I really appreciate Speaker Kotek, Senator Dembro, Senator Edwards put in Senate Bill 1575 on our request this session, which is kind of the same framework that we're basically looking at for the broad housing package. We spent a lot of time over the last couple of interims with the Speaker's office, Representative Kenny Geyer, other legislators, Senator Dembrough was involved, talking about the issue of affordable housing and how we do have a crisis. I think everybody will stipulate to that. What hasn't been stipulated to, and I think what 1533 gets close to, is an agreement on how to move forward in a productive fashion. This is an extraordinarily complicated issue, as you all know, and you really can't get, if we're going to get serious about affordable housing, I'll hop on the soapbox, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I'll hop right back off. I've been in this building for a long time. Housing has never been a priority for this legislature. I'm not mad at any of you or your predecessors. It's simply a statement of fact. It has not been a priority. We now have a crisis. Yes, people are paying attention, but we got into this crisis because of policy choices or lacks of policy choices over several decades that have resulted now in the situation we're finding intolerable, and as we should. I don't think there are no magic bullets. If we could have figured out how to do this easily, we'd have done it at some point during that time. You have to talk about tax policy. You have to talk about infrastructure. You have to talk about land use. You have to talk about all of those things if you're going to get serious. And my pledge to you, as I've given to the Speaker, is if we're going to have that conversation, I'm in. Or we can keep having the same old fistfights over and over. Those are entertaining but not productive. We've been fighting about inclusionary zoning since the bill we put in 1999. We've been fighting about rent control since 1985 to some degree or another. We've been fighting about excise taxes since 2007. All these issues have been in front of us. But all along in there has not been this body or the House or the governors, in the plural, focusing on housing. And I'm, like I said, I've been around a long time. I remember when the legislature used to meet in August talking about school funding. They've never stayed 5 minutes over a Ways and Means meeting talking about housing. So I think we all own this issue. Developers do, realtors do, legislators do, activists do, you name it. We all own a piece of it. We don't own an exclusive part. What I think this bill does is put some of those old fights to the side and allows us then to get some mental and psychological clarity to move forward onto those bigger conversations. And Mr. Gilliam's mentioned some context, and I'll add to it. According to the State Economist's Office, we should be building about 25,000 housing units in Oregon every year. Single family, multifamily, for rent, for sale, across the board, 25,000 housing units. Last year we did 15. So we're 10,000 units short from last year. We've been about 10 or more thousand units short ever since the recession. We probably have 100,000 unit shortfall year over year, in addition to the units we're not building going forward. So from our standpoint, from the development community standpoint, and I think a lot of legislators and others, the one thing we do not want this body to do, or cities to do, or counties to do, is adopt programs that make that problem worse. You have to have more units being built. Talk about price range, a separate conversation, but you have to end up having more units built, or else the problem is going to be exacerbated. And it's not an ideological issue. Yes, there's a lot of very horrible stories out there of people who are suffering in this current economic climate with the housing prices, but the solution isn't ideological, it's economic. We have to create the framework within which those extra units can get built, and it has to be built both by the private sector and the public and nonprofit sector. I think 1533 is a good bill. My members aren't entirely happy with it. The excise tax piece kind of irritates us, frankly, because we're going to be paying it, or our customers are going to be paying it, to go towards housing, which is a general public good. That's really something the general public ought to be paying for, but as a way of priming that pump and putting the money back into the system is something, one place we can get to, that you raise the price of market rate housing by the cost of this tax if locals adopt it, and it gets rolled back into, as this bill discusses, into things that then help pry it down. Some of the local governments, for the most part, lack financial tools, and Senator Hass and I have had this conversation and probably will continue to have the conversation about tax reform and local property tax reform in specifics, but they don't have the money to buy down SDCs. They don't have the money to buy down their development costs. We fund infrastructure in the state on new development through system development charges, and I can point you to project after project after subdivision where the impact fees are in the neighborhood of $30,000 to $50,000 a house. Those are legitimate numbers because we'd have sued the city if they weren't, but that makes it really hard to deliver affordable housing when you have that much going out for water, sewer, transportation, and so forth. This provides some money for the city could write those costs down through the construction excise tax. Those are the sorts of things we're referring to in this bill. Other financing methods might include such things as paying off, maybe the city participates in private mortgage insurance or some other ways of helping the home buyer get a little bit of a break on their financing. We think this conversation is a good one. We think we'll get it concluded shortly. The Dash 4s have, from our standpoint, and I can't speak to, there's a lot of moving parts here, I can't speak to all of them, the part that I'm watching, there's some tweaks. It's technical stuff. It's changing the to the in a couple places, making sure cross-references work and that sort of thing. Nothing major. I think the primary sticking point is one with which I'm not familiar, and that's tax abatement programs on multifamily construction for rent that I only found out about a week ago. So I wouldn't want to take a quiz on them, and I'm probably not going to be asked to negotiate them. But I think that sounds to me like something that can get resolved between the people that actually understand what the programs do, and we'll be able to come back to you with a bill that actually, I believe, helps make a clear statement about affordable housing, this legislature's response to it, and puts us in a position where good will be done, and avoid most of the inadvertent consequences. Be glad to take any questions.
Thank you. I just wanted to make clear the land use bill that you referenced, Sean, is that your support is of this bill generally with these amendments that, if they fix those tweaks, it is not linked to any of those bills in the House, with the success or failure of those bills.
Mr. Chair, actually, to the contrary, I think we believe this as a package and four bills, two of which were in House rules. One has moved to the floor with our support. One has moved to Ways and Means with our support. You have this bill, and then there's one other bill that Senator Beyer introduced as part of what we view as sort of the housing package.
Well, I wish I could control what happens over there, but I can't. And so this bill has to live or die on its own, Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sean, you mentioned in your discussion a group of folks who have discussed and agreed to this package. Can you tell me who the other people in that are?
Mr. Chair and Senator Riley, I believe you'll probably hear from some of them in this committee. Metro or Multifamily Northwest with Gwen Baldwin was one of the people. I know that the other main landlord groups have agreed to sort of the tenant protection piece, which is in 41-43, which is going to the House floor. On the development side, you have the realtors and the home builders agreeing to 1533 and some of the other land use pieces. So we have been in dialogue with the Speaker, Representative Kenny Geyer, Senator Dembro, for the last 6+ months, I would say, Senator. Actually, it's been longer than that, but serious dialogue as far as having sort of interim meetings to discuss what a housing package would look like, what the development community wants, what the advocates want as far as inclusionary zoning. And I think we sort of came to a final agreement with the Speaker and now with Senator Dembro in the last couple of days. So that's sort of, hopefully you'll hear from some of the other groups, but I can speak from the developers I represent, the realtors that I represent, and obviously Mr. Chandler sitting here next to us.
Follow up, please. So could you tell me some of the advocates who were in that group?
In the work group with Representative Kenny Geyer, Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, the room was large. I mean, there was at least 20 people in a lot of those meetings. So I think you'd have to ask some of those folks. I honestly don't remember all of them that have been included in it.
Thank you.
Senator Edwards.
Real quickly, so clarification from each of you. Realtors support A4s or next iteration, but not the bill as it currently sits, correct?
That is, Mr. Chair, Senator Edwards, correct.
Okay. Home builders are okay with the bill as it currently sits, but also okay with A4s and the next iteration?
Oh, Mr. Chair, Senator, no. We don't like it. We have seen this entire issue as a series of conversations being memorialized by amendments, right? So the dash twos were, as of that moment of the conversation, where we were, but we weren't done talking because we had the other moving parts in there floating around this building in other places, and we also had the details of this. So we would not be in accordance with the dash twos moving. In fact, we would oppose that. We do think this bill gets a lot closer to what we can support with tweaks.
Thank you for the clarification.
And on the question of the authority of the construction tax to Metro?
Mr. Chair, we support the A4 amendments.
You oppose giving Metro that authority?
Mr. Chair, we support the language the way it's drafted. We would not be willing to have that conversation about additional changes on that particular piece.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, no, we don't. We would not support adding Metro to the bill.
Okay. I do appreciate you moving closer to the center on this issue.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we still have a lot of people to go through. We're going to adjourn it or take a recess at 9:45. So, Mary Kyle McCurdy.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mary Kyle McCurdy, Policy Director at 1000 Friends of Oregon. We support Senate Bill 1533A as it passed out of the Human Services Committee and is before you today. And we are part of the very broad coalition that was described to you by Nikki Terziev. Oregon's land use planning program includes Goal 10, the housing goal, which requires that all cities and counties plan their land to ensure the provision of housing for all, including affordable housing. And we've been involved with that since the beginning of the program. Inclusionary zoning is a tool which, unlike other affordable housing tools, ensures that those of low and moderate income are integrated into existing communities and housing developments. It has some unique aspects. I'm going to talk about two aspects of a bill that is before you and what are in the dash three and dash fours that we oppose. And my perspective comes from speaking in particular to communities in throughout Oregon in small cities and rural towns. They have affordable housing challenges and local builders and housing markets that are different from the Portland metropolitan region. In particular, many of them are cultural and recreational and tourism destinations. They have retirement communities. They have short-term vacation rentals that are challenging. And about half of their workers work in the tourism, retail, sales, office sector, and therefore are of low and moderate income. The bill before you that has passed the Senate Housing Committee, SB 1533A, or Human Services Committee, excuse me, includes a floor of 10 units for developments to which inclusionary zoning would apply. The dash three and dash four proposals raise that to 20 units. Now, there's a concern among the smaller communities that I described that that would not only preclude their using inclusionary zoning by raising it to a 20-unit minimum, but it would have a perverse impact on their local housing markets by driving development down to a smaller number of multifamily units and single-family housing, which is not what they're needing in their affordable housing community. That will result in fewer housing units being built in those communities overall, contrary to the need that Mr. Chandler just described for more housing. We do need more housing and more affordable housing. Having a floor of 20 units could have a perverse impact on these smaller communities. In addition, the bill before you offers a list of incentives from which communities must choose if they choose to implement inclusionary zoning. A list of incentives of incentives for builders, such as SDC waivers, density bonuses, etc. The dash threes and dash fours constrict that list of incentives and require certain financial incentives to be offered by cities. Again, that can be too restrictive for the smaller cities and towns who would like a full list of options to craft a local inclusionary zoning option that they can use in their communities with their local builders. The communities from Hood River to Medford to Bend are stepping up to meet the affordable housing needs and housing needs of all. They're looking at, and some have adopted, increasing densities. Medford just rezoned over 500 acres within the urban growth boundary from single family to multifamily housing at the stroke of a pen, more than quadrupling the number of housing units possible in that community. Hood River and Bend are looking at accessory dwelling units, increasing densities, other tools. They are not only looking at inclusionary housing, but they view this as an essential option for them to be able to use to meet housing needs for all of their residents. Thank you.
Questions for Mary Kyle McCurdy. Clyde Holland, Dennis Allen from the Holland Partner Group.
Good morning, Chairman Hass and other committee members. My name is Clyde Holland. I'm the chairman and CEO of the Holland Partner Group. We very much appreciate the chance to be before you today. By way of background, I'm a developer. And developer of multifamily housing. And over the last 25 years, we've built more apartment communities in Oregon than any other developer in my role at Holland and my previous role as chairman of the Trammell Crow Residential Group. Oregon has been a leader in smart growth. And as we look at the smart growth and our focus on building workforce housing, we come to you today with compliments for some very good work. The testimony that Joe Courtwright has put into the record, and also referring to the recent study that is also in the record, Perspectives on Helping Low-Income California Housing, that was just released by their state government, looking at the effects of housing. We're also here in support of the whole overall development community. While our single-family brethren have successfully lobbied for the inclusionary zoning to only apply to multifamily housing, and understanding that the elements of where we are, this is a very complex question. One element, which is also a part of the study that we included in our white paper, which is before you as well, 47% of the communities, for instance, in Boston have used inclusionary zoning to effectively prohibit apartments. They don't want those people living in their towns. And so they put inclusionary zoning requirements in place that make development uneconomic, and thereby using that. If you look at the testimony that we gave in Wilsonville for the last apartment project to be zoned there, you'll see adamant testimony that not one a new apartment needs to be built in Wilsonville ever. And I note for the record that Wilsonville is very supportive of the inclusionary housing from that standpoint. Before you today, you look at the key provisions that came out of Senator Dembrow and Speaker Kotak's elements. One of the essential elements was clear and objective standards. And when you look at this broad element of housing, having clear and objective standards across all locations, therefore, we are objecting to the 8B exclusion of the urban cores or cities over 500,000. If you look at apartments, apartments are necessary in the locations where there are job centers. In the job centers that and where the demand is the most now is in the urban walkable urban core and on transit that serves those urban core. There's not another place in the state where clear and objective standards are more necessary, because if you don't get the balance right, then you will prohibit and significantly limit supply. And in limiting that supply, you're going to starve, from a revenue standpoint, the very essential services that are necessary: transportation, police, fire, education. And the level of production today is dramatically below what's necessary to meet demand. In our white paper, which we put before you, we have cited 40,000 units of apartment shortage, and the city of Portland has also gone on record that they're over 20,000 units short. But the plan to be able to allow the market to build those units is not before you. In our white paper, we cited the 40,000 units is in order to deliver the 40,000 units in the urban core and on transportation corridors, we need $14 billion of investment. We have a plan for that in terms of looking at it. That $14 billion will create over $500 million in Oregon income tax and over $200 million a year in annual property tax. Looking carefully at the clear and objective standards that we feel like are absolutely essential across the board, particularly in the urban cores and in the transportation, so that it is actually possible to build the housing, we feel is critical. We fully support the building of affordable housing. In fact, at our Rinco Station pilot project in the city of Hillsborough, we worked carefully with the affordable housing groups, and there will be four specific phases in there, all walkable to the transportation, to the Intel shuttle, to the TriMet buses, and we were able to triple the density of all of the housing, adding another 750 units of housing that would allow families to eliminate a car, to not have that additional expense, et cetera. Without those clear and objective standards, and without standards that are thoughtful, the ability to accomplish that would be significantly compromised, lowering the number of housing units that can be built and exacerbating the concerns that we have. Another element that has been spoken here there's very different paths. There are voluntary programs, and then there's mandatory programs. And before you, there's been lots of testimony and lots of testimony in the record that people would like to lower the 80% multifamily income threshold that's currently as it was coming out of the speaker and Senator Dembrow's good work. If you lower that further on a mandatory basis, you run the risk of severe jeopardizing the ability to actually build apartments. On a voluntary basis, targeting 60% or an average of 60%, completely good, because that voluntary means it's balanced. It means the incentives and the burdens and benefits are balanced from that standpoint. The other aspect of this, which speaks to the need for clear and objective standards, particularly in the urban core, is high-rise development. In the urban core, cities and the state has already paid for all the infrastructure. The streets are all in. The water's in, all the services are in. If you have policies that have an economic inverse perspective, you end up making high-rise unaffordable because of the significant increase in cost of going up. But what you do is you cut by a third in a wood frame project compared to a high-rise the amount of SDCs that get paid. So those are permanent loss. So that's two-thirds of the SDCs that could have been paid if a high-rise had been able to move forward are never going to be collected. Also, a high-rise will pay three times the property taxes over forever that would be paid if you have a lower density development. And so specifically within the clear and objective standards, we ask you to include a provision that says there will not be a disincentive for building high-rise development on an economic basis. Otherwise, the state is at severe risk of loss of that income and the SDC impact fees that would go along with that. So in closing, I would just like to say we are fully supportive of housing. We're fully supportive of workforce housing. That's been our passion and our development for the last 25 years here in delivering this. We also have in the record the full element of how we would look at solving the housing crisis that is before you.
Thank you, Mr. Holland, for coming down today. Orenco Station has been nationally recognized. Congratulations for your work on that. Let me ask you your opinion, I guess, of the housing crisis such that it exists in Oregon. How much of the shortage is in the Portland area, percentage-wise?
You have to look at
the changing
structure of the American family. 25 years ago, 75% of family units were married with children. Today, it's absolutely the inverse. It's 25% are married with children. 75% are basically individuals, either single or couples, et cetera, with no kids. I'd say if you look at the housing shortage, at least 80% is in the urban core. The issue is, in America, we at post-World War II, we put jobs here and housing there, and as opposed to pre-World War II, housing and jobs were as close together as you could get them. The way to solve this housing crisis, and what is included in our white paper, is build 25,000 units of high-rise housing in the urban core where all of the infrastructure completely exists today. There's no additional cost to the state to do that. And with that, you'll create, and it's 25,000 units of high-rise housing in the urban core and 15,000 units within a half mile of transit locations, allowing all families access to public transportation. And that cost on a family basis is $9,000 a year, about 15% of their income. You will basically reduce the burden if you put the housing in the right location. In addition, the $200 million of property tax annually is the best source for affordable housing in perpetuity without increasing the market. To go to an 80% MFI on 20% of the units, barring incentives, it will increase the cost approximately 15% on all of the rest of the housing. And the key element that I would encourage you to consider is when you're financing the next project, you have to look at the economics. Right now, institutions want a 6% return in order for us to build an apartment. I've been successful in getting them to move that return down, allowing us to do more units, to approximately 5.5%. But if you set aside 20% of those units and say, I'm going to charge an 80% MFI, which is what's in before you today, outside of the clear and objective standards where you have to balance that, the other market rate units, 80%, have to pay 15% more. But it's just not those units. The whole market has to move up to support that. There are 125,092 apartments in the city of Portland. And this is a vital and critical element, because unless there are objective standards, the entire market is going to get that impact. You'll take the average cost of housing and drive it up 15% to afford the next units under an inclusionary zoning scenario. Because when an appraiser does a project, they're not going to say, well, let's see, the one that wants to be built now has to do affordable housing, so the one next door can charge, it needs to be $400 more per month for the regular market rate. Unless the project next door is demonstrating that it's getting the $400, you're not going to get the project appraised or financed.
Well, if I follow that logic, then you would be opposed to doing anything.
As long as the incentives... As the incentives are balanced, if you have a property tax incentive, if you have a write-down of the SDCs so that the cost of the project is lowered, then you're not going to push the cost into the market rate housing.
Okay.
If you don't have those costs balanced, there's no place for it to go. You've heard testimony, we've heard some testimony that sometimes developers wear a black cape. I can assure you that from our standpoint, there's nobody that wants to build more than we do. And we are accessing the lowest possible cost of financing, and there's simply no other places to go in terms of looking at what happens if you eliminate a chunk of revenue. So we're here in support of clear and objective standards that are balanced. So if the incentives are right, we'd love to include the affordable people. We are a leader in tax-exempt bond financing, HUD, and tax credit financing, and been very supportive of the affordable housing elements where we can make the numbers work and gain the financing.
Questions? Any questions? Senator Bartsugger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So thanks for your testimony. I think I think you brought to light into the conversation that it really boils down to a mathematical
It is. Equation. It's just math.
It's just math. And I appreciate that testimony, because I don't think some people understand that. If it doesn't pencil, it doesn't pencil, and you can't go forward. So, thank
well,
you.
My concern, and the concern that I would just ask you to look at, is we have a housing crisis because we don't have enough housing. What we haven't heard is, here's how we're going to build 40,000 more apartments in the region, and because we're lined up to help. I can assure you there's nobody that would like to build 40,000 units more than we would, and the other compatriots that we have. What we haven't seen is the math that says here's how we make it work, and that gives us some concern. But with clear and objective standards, so that it can be possible, which is part of what's happened, we think we could be a positive part of that solution. But if you include 8B, the very place that you need housing is going to have it excluded. And there isn't that objective, clear and objective standard, which at that point in time, we think you significantly exacerbate the current issues we have.
Quick question. You've referenced 8B a couple times.
That is in the A4, A3, and A4 amendments.
Okay. So in the A3 and the A4 amendments, are we talking Section 8B? Is that what?
Yes. It's okay. Essentially, it's the exemption for the city of Portland to have to follow the clear and objective standards.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you both.
Dennis.
Yeah, I'll be quick. Dennis, Chair and members of the committee, Dennis Allen, Managing Director of Holland Partner Group for the Oregon Region. I would also like to thank Speaker Kotek, Senator Dembrow, Senator Edwards, and everybody for all the hard work that's been done on this. I've been very involved with the drafting of the language as well. We're in support of the agreement in general with some sort of important clarifications. As Clyde stated, the biggest risk with inclusionary zoning is the limiting of supply. There's many studies out there that show that. As a matter of fact, there hasn't been a single municipality that has a mandatory program that's produced more than a couple of hundred units a year. We need thousands. We agree with everybody that's come before us. We need thousands of units, both market rate and affordable rate. The risk, if you don't get the incentives right, is that you stunt all of the growth of that. So we think the clarification changes in the existing language are important. Number one is to add to Section 1, Paragraph 8A, and I believe these are in the A3 and the A4s. I don't think it's changed, although I'm specifically looking at the A3s when I did this. We think added to it should be that any city or county that implements the inclusionary zoning policy must demonstrate that they have policies that support producing a sufficient supply of housing to meet current and future demand. So you should have a policy in place that shows that there's something that's going to tie with the demand that's necessary now and where you're behind, and in the future to say, here's the policies that will support more density, more production, whatever it is, and then we can implement the right policies in place to include with it the affordable homes that need to go along with it that are desperately needed. Secondly, we think, as Clyde stated, you should remove Section 1, Paragraph 8B. We believe that all cities should follow the standards that were set forth in Section 8A. That preceded it, so that should just be removed. And then lastly, in modify Section 1, Paragraph 5C, capital A through C, I think the removal of the for sale restriction should be lifted. When we were drafting or talking about this section, the idea was that a property tax exemption only applied to multi or rental, which is true because they have an ongoing cash flow stream. I think the language was incorrect in that it removed the ability for rental product to also have the potential incentives of fee reductions, other financial incentives. So the way it's written right now is that only a for sale product could get the fee waivers and all these other things, and only the rental product could get the tax abatement. I think the way it should be is that only the rental product gets the tax abatement because he's the only one that's applicable, but the other incentives could be offered to either for sale or for rent. And that gives any municipality, any city, the ability to craft with a creative structure the incentives they need to align it so that they don't stunt the supply of the growth.
Okay. Thank you for those recommendations. Senator Riley.
Yeah. Once again, yeah, I hear the word the agreement, and I'm not clear who are the people who are making the agreement. Can you tell me who agreed to this agreement?
You know, Senator Riley, I will side with Sean Gillian's, which is it's a lot, and I don't remember all the names of the groups. I do know.
So the answer is you don't know.
Well, I do know that there's been parties from both sides. So the City of Portland, I think we've had the Home Builders, the Realtors Association, we've had several groups, Thousand Friends of Oregon, and others like those. So pro groups as well that have been involved with the drafting.
So Thousand Friends is part of this agreement.
You know what? I'm not sure if they were 100%. But I
shaking
do know
their head. So
no or yes, no. Okay, so there have been groups that have been. I don't know the names of all them, but I'm sure somebody can provide that.
Senator, I would like that if someone could provide that to me. I'm curious,
Senator. Here's what I would say: this is an incredibly complex subject. Yep. It's very simple at its heart, but the way it's applied, you have single-family builders on the edge of town, you have duplexes a little farther in, you have garden apartment communities in many of the outlying suburban areas, you have higher densities. As you move to the city core, the type of housing that we're talking about, where it's located, whether it's transportation-related, whether it's walkable, how it works, all of the different constituents that are building those different types of housing have different pressures. There's different cost structures, there's different elements. And what we're trying to do in a 35-day session is to bring all of the voices, which have been working really hard on it for a long time, but no one has put the math in front of anyone. Everybody completely agrees we need housing,
right?
A lot of housing. We need significant amounts of affordable housing.
So you don't have the answer to my question either. Is that correct?
We are one of the groups that are trying very hard to do this.
Yeah.
Thank you both.
Yep.
We are at the end, but I want to be courteous to two people who have come from out of town and give them the final 2 minutes, John Van Landingham and Elena Kunagi, if you want to come up and briefly state where you are on these bills, your amendments, and we appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Chair Hass, Senators, for allowing a brief moment. I won't say much. A lot of what I had to say has been said. But I will say that I testified against Senate Bill 1575 for affordable housing, and I'm here to support 1533. I think it takes a much longer-term approach. As somebody who's 27 years old and intends on raising my family here in Oregon, I live in between Albany and Corvallis, and I see housing problems there. I think that keeping those keeping the threshold for the below 600,000 at 10 units for that that mandate there is a good provision to keep in there. And I also see when I left for college, out of state, came back, I have seen astronomical numbers of people from my generation immigrating here to Portland, to Oregon. In the long run, we have a huge amount of people that are going to live here. Portland's the next Mecca. And eventually those people are going to start spreading out from Portland into those other communities. And I think that this bill, as it doesn't attack land use, provides a much more long-term sustainable approach.
Thank you.
Van Landingham. Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is John Van Landingham. I work as a lawyer for Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center in Eugene. I've been an affordable housing advocate and tenant, low-income tenant advocate in this building for 25 years and in Lane County for 35 years. I also served as a member of the Land Conservation and Development Commission for 12 years and as chair for seven, ending in 2012. So I have both experiences. What I have to say would take more than 2 minutes, so I don't know how you want to approach that. For example, I can answer Senator Riley's question if you want. I would mainly say that I support both aspects of 1533. I've been involved in working on all four parts of the omnibus proposal. Not that I have any veto power or control over what gets done with those four parts, but suggesting changes.
Welcome to our club.
Yes, yes. Last night at 7 p.m., I suggested to the speaker some amendments to the Dash 4s to make them work better. I view myself as an expert on property tax exemptions in the state of Oregon, and the proposals in the Dash 4 don't quite work. I think they can get to working. I spent about a half an hour on the phone last night with the city attorney for the city of Portland trying to help them understand the property tax exemption that is in the Dash 4s. I think it would work for Portland. Eugene uses it. Bend uses it. I believe I can also provide some information with regard to the clear and objective standard issue, point out to you that that's already in state law, in both A and B of subsection 8 in the first section of the bill. So even if you took it out of this bill, it's still in state law. I think the development community wants it in this bill because they feel like it's not being enforced. You can't really take away 8B because it's in state law. You'd have to amend 197.307 where that is in the land use statutes. I could keep talking, but
I appreciate you summarizing like that. I really do, and I know that you and your colleagues are making the rounds with stakeholders. That's very, very helpful.
Thank you.
Questions to either one of these two, Senator Riley?
So, John, you said you could answer my question.
Chair Haas, Senator Riley, there have been a number of meetings. Some people have been at some meetings, and some people have been at other meetings. I would say the first meetings were called by the Speaker and Representative Kenny Geyer in December, there were sort of two groups. Some of us are involved in both groups. One is landlord-tenant issues that led to House Bill 4143. Some are in the development community. So in that room were Gwen Baldwin and Deborah Imsey from Multifamily Northwest, a landlord group, Jim Straub and his lobbyist Sean Miller from the Oregon Rental Housing Association, Cindy Robert and Phil Owen on behalf of another landlord group whose name I often forget.
Let me stop you.
Okay.
You're talking about December, and I want to know about, we keep talking about a current agreement.
So, Chair Haas, Senator Riley, I started there because those discussions led to where we are today.
Fine.
So when you're talking about group meetings, you can't ignore
I'm not talking about group meetings. I'm talking about who's party to what you call the agreement.
Chair Haas, Senator Riley, the overall structure agreement, there's a two-page document. You've probably seen it. It's been shared with lots of people. That the elements of that were negotiated by the Speaker and the development community and landlords. I was not in that room. I was not asked about that deal. I support that deal, even though I was not at that table. The rest of the people you've heard testify against the deal or with concerns about the deal, Inclusionary Zoning Coalition, Thousand Friends of Oregon, MACG, tenant advocates, City of Portland, were not in that room to negotiate that. Senator Denbrough had a meeting, I believe, last week that he called the big table. A lot of those people were in that room, including, I think, the City of Portland. I was not. I don't believe that the IZ Coalition was in that room, although I don't know. I wasn't in that room. Yesterday, the Speaker's staff had a meeting with all of us that are interested in this bill, except for the development community and landlords. So there's a number of meetings that have been going on.
Thank you for that answer. And I really appreciate the work you do on this and over the years, too.
Thank you.
Elena, thank you. We still have a few people we'll try to catch up with next week. And so for now, we will close the public hearing on 1533. I hope we can continue working in the meantime tomorrow and over the weekend. And for now, this committee will recess until 2:30. Revenue will resume after our recess. I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 1507. We have two amendments, and the one is the one that we discussed regarding film and video and biomass. There is another one we haven't spent amount of time on, or at least not recently, that has to do with clawback provisions, and that amendment has been pretty standard on the other tax credits from previous sessions. So I want to give a minute to Chris to walk us through that clawback provision and why we do it.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. That the clawback, the main amendment is the -8. The clawback amendment is the -7, and this is just language that is taken from other energy tax credits. And as the committees have moved forward in recent years and sessions on really getting into the policies behind the tax credits, there are cases where taxpayers incorrectly claim too much tax credit. And so the state goes through a process to reclaim those tax credits. And a lot of attention has been paid to credits that are transferable so that a person who purchases a tax credit is held harmless in the process. It's just the entity that earned the tax credit. So that it doesn't interfere with the transferee process. And so this language here was on our list of issues to deal with in 2017, kind of the normal cycle for the tax credits, because that's when the energy tax credits are going to be up for review. But with the extension of the biomass manure tax credit in the -8 amendment, it kind of raises that issue about adding that clawback provision. This clawback language is the language that's in statute related to other tax credits. So it's just that standard language. There's no revenue impact. There's no fiscal impact. It's just a policy that the revenue committees have been adopting as they've gone through the statutes.
So we're doing 7 and 8?
7 and 8, yes. Everybody okay with that explanation? -7s.
Now let's look at the -8.
And yeah, you want to walk us through the main amendment.
Okay, so the -8. You do have a revenue impact. There is it's either a no or minimal fiscal impact. The revenue impact statement for the four core pieces of the bill, there's no impact. The two pieces that do have the impact are the film and video and biomass tax credits. And taken together, that revenue impact is a $200,000 loss in 15-17 and then going to $10 million and about $17 or $18 million in 19-21. Just to refresh everybody's memory, the film and video tax credit is increased from a $10 million cap to $12 million this year and then to $14 million next year. And also effective next year would be the change in the allocation of the funds. from that are raised from the sale of the tax credits. One piece, so this does include the original, it is the original 1578 and also the dash one amendment to the 1578, which allocates more funds to the rural parts of the state, or at least the non-Portland area. And part of the language in the dash eight, there's a definition of the Portland metropolitan zone, and it makes it easier for some of the filming to go outside of the Portland area. The biomass manure tax credit is extended to January 1, 2022, and the tax credit rate is reduced from $5 to $3.50 beginning this year in 2016. And that was a change from earlier discussions where the original amendment had that starting in, had that lower rate starting in 2017. That starts in 2016. And so basically for the 1517 biennium, the increased cost of the film and video credit is largely offset by a revenue gain from the lower rate for the biomass tax credit. And so you get to a $200,000 revenue loss. And as is has become a custom in the revenue committees, there is a note here at the bottom of the revenue impact statement relating to tax expenditures. I have put draft language in here regarding the policy purpose of the change in the film and video credit and the biomass manure tax credit. And basically, the policy purpose of the change in the film and video tax credit is to increase the capacity of the state to develop a sustainable infrastructure for this industry in Oregon. And the policy purpose of the change in the biomass manure tax credit is to increase the capital investment in manure digesters. This is really just draft language for the committee to consider. It's often easier to edit something than to come up with new language. Mm-hmm. So if anybody has changes that they would like to make, just send them to me and I can make those changes in the statement.
Okay.
Do we have, Chris, the little chart that shows the tax credit like we usually put up?
Yeah, it's on OLIS. You don't have your computer, and it didn't. It was on your screen. Maybe we could.
I think Paul.
I'm a visual person. Chair has.
That's the old one. We do have. It's under meeting materials. Yeah, that's the dash eight. So there is a typo in there. The film and video is not dash 88. Sometimes it feels like it. It's just the dash 8.
Okay.
So this lays out the annual impacts, and then is that the chart you're looking for, Senator?
And I think that, you know, obviously Senator Boquist is excused, but I think that is along the lines of what he and I talked about earlier this week on this bill, adding those two credits, and as we refer to them as biomass light, film and video light, and I think that is representative of where he wanted to be. And obviously, he's excused for this vote. So, any other comments on the sevens or eights?
Nope.
Could you make a motion on the sevens?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash seven amendment dated 2/18/16 to Senate Bill 1507.
Senator Riley moves dash sevens to 1507. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 8 amendment to dated 2/18/16 to Senate Bill 1507.
Senator Riley moves the dash 8s to Senate Bill 1507. Discussion? Objections? Seeing none, motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1507 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Riley moves Senate Bill 1507 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections? Seeing none, Senate Bill 1507 moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do pass recommendation. I'll be the carrier. All right. Thanks, gents. I know Senator Edwards has to go to his committee. We are adjourned.